Hello and welcome to the Photo Buzz podcast. I'm Andrew James.
And I'm John Adams.
And we're here to chat about all things photographic, put the world to rights, and give you a few tips and tricks to think about when you're out with your camera. I want to kick off with an issue that's been raising its head pretty much since photography began, and that issue is manipulation. John, your thoughts, please.
On manipulation. Well, I guess the first thing we've got to do is decide what we mean by manipulation. Define your terms, dear boy. What are we talking about with manipulation? Because, I mean, you could actually say that, well, film photography, which is about as pure as it gets, that was full of manipulation. You could choose a particular stock of film. Like, I'll give you an example. Fuji Velvia, really popular landscape stock of old, you know, 50 ISO, fantastic film, but it was about 40% oversaturated. So it gave you a kind of a false colour, a false colour palette on the world, because it made it look more attractive, warmer and more saturated. So that was, by just putting a particular stock of film in, it was manipulation, you know, going on straight away. Or a black and white film, you know, you load up with a bit of FP4 or something like that, and you're automatically manipulating the way the planet looks. So yeah, what do you mean by manipulation?
Well, I like the fact, first of all, I really love the fact that you say we need to define what manipulation is, and then you started defending manipulation before we get any further. And also, you did a brilliant Sir John Gielgud impersonation at the start of that, so just think that was worth noting. What do I mean by manipulation? Well, I think we've got to bring it up to date, haven't we? We live now in a digital age. I'm talking about manipulation in Photoshop or other software. And what I kind of want us to talk about here is what's acceptable and what isn't when it comes to image manipulation. When does a photograph, something that you've captured in a moment in time, become over-manipulated?
I don't know if it does. I think you'd have to look at the intended kind of purpose. What's the use of the picture? If you're doing something for art's sake, if you're doing a creative piece, let's say you're doing an album cover for a band, something like that. I don't think there are any limits as to what you can do. I guess if you're shooting something that you're saying is reality, something that you're saying is true, then you would automatically have some lines drawn. You'd have some restrictions on it. Like wildlife is a good example. Yeah. If you're going to, you know, take a shot of, you're out in the Masai Mara, you want to get some wonderful pictures of animals. If you manipulate those and you start replacing eyes and putting different backgrounds in, there's something that feels kind of wrong about that, because you're going out with the intent to represent the truth, if you like, with a capital T. But what you're actually doing is creating photo art. So you're taking the ethics of making an album cover and planting it into a wildlife environment. I think you could still do that, but if you'd have to be honest with that. You'd have to just say, by the way, I've taken this zebra out of its original environment and stuck it on a tower block for the sake of my album cover.
I really like the fact that you mentioned a zebra, because it just took me back to, I don't know how many years ago, when we were in the Masai Mara and we were both photographing, I think it was a zebra or some zebra, in front of Mount Kenya, I think.
Yeah.
And later on, when we came back and you were doing something for the magazine for Digital Photo, and I discovered that you'd basically moved the blinking zebra about 15 feet to the right to line it up better with Mount Kenya. So that's exactly what I'm talking about. Is that acceptable? Because that's not something I would have done then or I would do now. I guess you were being honest with it, because it was a whole process of you're manipulating for a reason.
Yes, I mean, that particular shot, it's odd. When you're doing tutorials, I mean, at that stage in my career, I was doing a lot of Photoshop tutorials, and you have to have something to tutor about. And that particular example, I could have waited or changed my angle and got a better shot of the zebra and Mount Kenya in the background. But what I needed to do was actually produce a tutorial that demonstrated how you can move something from one place to another place. So I shot a sort of a less good picture in order to make it better afterwards. So I suppose there's a degree of artificiality into it. But is it right or wrong? The context hasn't changed. All I've done is improved it. You could maybe do the same thing with cropping. Would that be manipulation? I feel like I'm being defensive all of a sudden now.
Yes, but I think you are a little bit.
But if I shot something too loose, if I shot my zebras there, Mount Kenya's nicely in the background, but I've left it too loose around the edges, so I crop in, and that's manipulation too, though it's a more subtle form of manipulation than taking the zebra out of where it is, shifting it, you know, a few percent to the left to improve the composition, and then cloning in and any details to make sure no one can see the join.
I mean, ultimately, the honesty word that you said is absolutely right. I actually think you can do anything you like as long as you're honest about it. Mm. And there's a point maybe where a photograph becomes digital art as a result of that. And I've got no issue with that. And I see some really beautiful stuff out there. But when it comes to kind of capturing something as it is, if you like, what you're seeing, I feel that manipulation goes too far if it changes the integrity of that scene, I guess, without being honest about it, without saying yes, there wasn't an office block behind the zebra in the Masai Mara, that kind of thing. So, well, you know, because manipulation, you know, if I'm going to shoot, I shoot HDR. I don't want it to look like HDR, but sometimes I'll merge three or four images, but. Yeah. I'm not changing anything that wasn't there at the time. I'm just making sure I'm capturing all those tones within that photograph by doing so. But it's still manipulation to a large degree.
That's an interesting point. Because I think we've almost got to divide manipulation into, there's two categories of manipulation. One is technical manipulation, where you're simply, your HDR example is a good one, because what you're doing with HDR is making sure you can capture the tones that you require to make a print, you know, to make your photo. And another example might be if you've got too much contrast. Let's imagine a typical UK landscape where your sky is about 2.5 stops brighter than your foreground. Now, the only way you're going to get a decent picture from that is by shooting the sky and the foreground separately and merging them together, or using something like a neutral density graduated filter to make the sky darker and you know, at the same time make the foreground brighter. So that you're manipulating the light as it is, but for the benefits of your camera. So your camera can function properly and do its job. You're actually indulging in manipulation by placing either shooting two exposures, shooting in HDR, or placing a graduated filter over the top. You're not changing anything. You're just using kind of technology to make sure you can capture a decent picture. I suppose we could call that technical manipulation.
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, if you're shooting RAW, you pretty much, you don't have to manipulate every time, or at least there's a levels of manipulation that you might need to do. But I don't see any issue in using RAW software like Lightroom, or there are other software out there that deals with RAW files, obviously. But I don't see any issue in manipulating the levels, the tones, the colours within that RAW file. So you're not changing anything, you're not putting anything into that image, but you are playing around with the look of that image. Again, for me, the biggest thing is, you know, you mentioned wildlife, but this, you know, equally applies to landscapes, and to some degree equally applies to portraiture or anything, frankly. And that is the fact that it generally, I want it to look natural. Mm-hmm. You know, as if, you know, that you know there's been manipulation, but that manipulation isn't at the expense of being somewhere in the ballpark area of what you'd expect to see with your own eyes.
Yeah, I think that's fine. I suppose the goalposts have shifted, because prior to the advent of RAW, which would have been in, you know, the early 2000s, I guess, before that it was just JPEG, where effectively an engineer at a camera factory decided how much contrast and what color saturation you would have, and they were as responsible for the quality, if you like, of your picture as you are, you know. So you've got an engineer sets up particular parameters to make your camera look a particular way, or the images look a particular way. RAW gives you the opportunity to make those decisions yourself, so you take more control over it. But I don't think anyone was ever talking about manipulation in that sense, because of what a Japanese engineer pre-programmed into your camera, and you didn't even know about it. You didn't have any choice. the pictures just looked as they looked.
Well, yeah, totally. I mean, I sometimes one of my few pleasures in life is to go onto some thread on Facebook or something, not to get involved, i.e., actually typing something in because it's too scary out there. But if there's a thread about photography because I see someone has posted something, and then a professional somewhere, and there's all these people debating, there's always one or two people. Let's call them Freddie Facebook and Fiona Facebook, saying you shouldn't manipulate nothing, that's wrong, learn how to take a photo in the first place. And these people make me absolutely laugh, because it's like, well, what isn't manipulated really? Because we manipulate the world with our lens, with the viewpoint that we shoot from, with pretty much everything. So I come around to your point of view more when you in order to be a good, or in order to present good pictures, I should say, I didn't say in order to be a good photographer, which is completely the wrong thing, but in order to present good images, you have to learn how to process, so I'm going to use not the manipulation word here, but process your raw files particularly really effectively, I think. And you can still shoot JPEG. Actually, fine JPEG will give you a great result. But of course, as you say, it's putting saturation in there and contrast. And actually, you can manipulate those things in the camera anyway. You can decide to put more contrast or more saturation or whatever it is you want to do in through the parameters within that JPEG. Almost every modern DSLR allows you to do that. I think probably everyone does. Absolutely everyone does. So, there is no way to shoot unprocessed, unmanipulated images now, or at least to present, yeah. Unless you literally shoot standard RAW and then just print that out. But why would you?
Yeah, well, I suppose kind of what you're saying is that a picture is data, and how you can push or pull various elements of that data to get the look you want. And I think that's what photography is. And you talked about lens choices. When you fit a wide angle lens, you're manipulating the way the world looks, because you're seeing it at a wider angle of view than your natural eye view would be. When you put a telephoto on, you're doing the same thing, but the kind of the inverse of that. So you are manipulating. As soon as you decide to capture something on a camera, you're making decisions and making choices which affect the, in inverted commas, the reality of the scene itself. That's what photography is. It is on being selective and choosing what you want to put across. I suppose what you're talking about, as far as I can work out, is if you start adding stuff or taking stuff away that was there, that's where you start to feel there's a line crossed.
Yeah, but then but having said that, I'm now kind of backtracking on my own views, as one can have a tendency to do with these debates. But I'm now thinking, well, but I'll happily clone out maybe it was a bit of rubbish in the corner of a landscape that I didn't notice at the time. I should have done, but I didn't notice it. It's not adding to the scene. It's not an integral part of that scene, so I will take it out. So there are certain things that I will do within the processing process that I've justified completely in my head. But on the other hand, I wouldn't move I wouldn't introduce a sky that wasn't there. If I've got a sky that's a little bit on the weak side, then in processing, yes, I will look to optimize that sky and get it to look as good as I possibly can, but I won't, so I'll be using the information that's there, but no more than that.
It's interesting. So you'd remove something that you didn't want to be there. Let's think of your rubbish. Let's say we've got a soft drinks can in the foreground of a landscape, and you could, of course, just kick it out the way, or put it in your rucksack and take it home with you.
Well, yeah, I should have done. Of course, I should have done.
So you could do that, but you weren't able to. Maybe there was a fence. No, whatever reason, you weren't able to move the soft drinks can, ruining your shot in the foreground.
I'm just stupid. So you didn't notice it. That's all, basically.
Oh yeah, maybe that. So you decide, retrospectively to clone it out. So you remove it. How does that differ from removing a sky that doesn't quite work?
Well, because if you're introducing a sky taken at a different time, and adding it to your picture, that was never there in the first place. So therefore, that kind of manipulation, and I don't have a problem with it, I just think you've got to be honest about it. When it becomes, then it's photo art, it's not a representation of the scene. Whereas taking a can of Coke out, a can of, you know, that's been discarded on the side of the new because you were too stupid to notice it at the time, is simply tidying up and making that place look as it should, because that can of Coke on the floor shouldn't have been there in the first place.
What if that thing was there in the first place? I feel I'm reaching for obscure examples, but if you've got, let's say, a gnarly tree stump in the foreground, and that's part of the reality of the scene, it's not something you could kick out the way, you know, had you noticed it. And on there is some graffiti, maybe there's some foul language or something on that gnarly tree stump, and that's going to detract from your picture and spoil it. You didn't notice it at the time or whatever. So you want the tree stump, but you don't want the graffiti on it. Does that come off? I'm wondering at what point... I'm looking for the line, because I don't think
there is one. That's the problem, isn't it, with this? There isn't actually a line.
I think it's down to purpose again, of the picture.
Yeah.
And I think that even extends to a sky. If you take a great landscape and the only thing that lets it down is the quality of the sky, and obviously the first port of call, because it would be efficient and quick to try and pull out cloud detail out of the sky, you would get, you know, a great looking shot using your existing content, your existing data from the picture. But if that data simply wasn't good enough, maybe the sky's burnt out or it's rubbish. You've got a great foreground, wonderful mountains, all the rest of it, but the sky is not doing it. With sufficient technology and skill, if you could put in a much better sky, maybe taken 10 minutes later, maybe taken, you know, 15 degrees to the left of your subject, is that okay?
No.
Why?
Because I say so.
So that's the line, is what I say.
Yes, exactly. Well, no, but it is for me, and I think, I guess that's the point, isn't it? The line in the sand on manipulation is where you want it to be.
Yeah.
I would advise, as a, you know, someone's been in photography a long time, people to decide what they think the line is in the sand is according to their own conscience. Don't be kind of feel that you can't do something just because somebody like me or you said you can't do this or you can do it or whatever else it may be. Just decide that same thing and kind of think about, yeah, the end game with this. I mean, obviously with competitions, a lot of, you know, if you want to enter competitions, yeah, you know they're often the digital manipulation rules mean that you can enhance or optimize a raw file, but you can't add and take things away, because that means it's a level playing field, and you know it's not, you know, not down to purely your processing skills, should we say, as opposed to your taking skills. So yeah, just decide where that line in the sand is and stick with that if that's what makes you happy. But if you want to change skies or, you know, change zebras or do whatever, then do that as well. But just don't pretend that's what the scene was like in the first place.
I think I'd have to agree with that. It's do what you want, but be honest about it is the only thing. I suppose it's just the deception, isn't it? It's avoiding deception in our photography is the important thing. And if you have manipulated, then, you know, fess up to it, be proud of it. And if you've made a better job by using manipulation than you would have done with the original picture, great. What's not to like? It's just you have to be honest about that process, because it's just another skill you've employed to make a picture.
Absolutely. So maybe we should just wrap this.
We'll draw that line in the sand under manipulation. Do what you like, but fess up to it.
Exactly. So photo buzzers, basically, do what you like, but be honest about it.
Time for Q&A now, photo buzzers, and we've got a great question from a photo buzzer who wishes to remain anonymous. I'm about to buy my first pro tripod, and I need to choose which head I get to go with it. Should I get a three-way head or a ball head? Advice, please. So that's the question. Andrew, any thoughts on that?
Well, I guess to start with, maybe we should define the differences between the two types of head. So a ball head is, I mean, it's really obvious this, so apologies for teaching my grandmother to suck eggs, everybody out there, but it's basically a tripod head that has a ball within a socket, which then can rotate pretty much any position you want within that socket for you to get the shooting position that you want.
Mm-hmm. And a three-way head has three arms. It operates, it works in three different axes. So you've got your tilt axes, your up and down, then you've got your side to side, your pan, and I don't know what the term is for the horizon one, a yaw or something like that, I guess. But you've got three different axes you can set the head to. I guess with the three-way head, that means you've got three motions to make, which all lock independently. So you've got a slower process, but ultimately a more accurate process for really fine-tuning your composition.
Yeah, I think, I mean, I'd say that that type of tripod head maybe gives you real kind of fine ultimate control over positioning. So when I've used one, and I have got one, but actually I don't like carrying, for example, for landscapes, I don't like carrying it because, you know, the bit sticking out, the handle coming out is just a pain in the bottom. I was going to say something very rude then for a
second.
You're
going to say arse, weren't you?
Yes, that's the word. I was going to say arse, yes. Oh, no. This has gone wrong. But anyway, carry on. Move on. This didn't really happen to anybody. Basically, yeah, that gets in the way. But when I have used it, I like using it often for things like macro photography, where I just need that real fine control. Whereas sometimes with some ball heads, you can get a little bit of creep here and there if you're not careful, if you're not locking it down properly. Whereas I think it's just easier to lock it down on the pan and tilt. I've forgotten the name of the thing. What are we called? Three-way head. Thank you. Pan and tilt was another name. Isn't quite a three-way. It's sort of the halfway house.
Yeah,
sort of
technically a two-way head, yeah. Isn't it? A pan and tilt head. But yeah, I mean, I think with ball heads, you've got something that's very quick to use and easy to set up. It's fast. That's the great thing about a ball head, but not hugely precise. Whereas a three-way head gives you the opportunity to be really precise, but you have to work slower. That can sometimes be a good thing with tripod use, because the idea of using a tripod and setting up meticulously and getting your composition just right is about slowing yourself down and really considering all aspects of it. I think given the choice, it depends what you're shooting, actually. If you're shooting landscapes, then I would say a ball head is probably the best thing to use, because you don't want to be faffing around setting three different axes of a tripod just to take a shot. Sometimes you need to work quite fast with landscapes, if the light's just fleeting.
Not just landscapes, John, I mean wildlife as well. I mean, you know, if you've got a really long lens, then you need one of the more specialist ball heads that are out there as well, that you can mount a bigger lens on it, that give you that kind of the ability to keep everything level but still move, swivel round if you've got a moving subject, which tends to be a prerequisite of wildlife photography. So yeah, I think the end use is pretty much kind of what you should be thinking about as your brain's working out what you need. I mean, the other thing to bear in mind is if you want to do video work with your digital SLR as well these days. I mean, you can do video work on any tripod head, ultimately, if you're just fixing it. But I think probably a three-way might, if you want to do some nice little subtle movements and very carefully. I mean, a video head would actually be even better, but a lot more expensive. But you could probably do more with a three-way than you could with a sort of a ball and socket style.
Yes, yeah, that's true. If you could pan smoothly with a three-way head, if you could. I mean, a fluid head, a video head would be the true answer if you're actually going to make camera movements from the tripod. But yeah, you couldn't really do that with a ball head at all. So that would be a downside to a ball head.
So what are we saying here? Because we're talking a lot, and have we actually given any really good solid advice?
I use both types of heads. If I'm in the studio and I'm doing meticulous stuff like macro work, or I'm doing something that requires really precise.
Well, so they've got to buy two tripods heads now.
Not necessarily. I think it depends. You bias your choice to what you're going to use most of the time. You can use either head for anything. I mean, that's plain and simple. It doesn't matter which one you go for. I would go for a ball head because that suits most of the work I do if I was just going to have one head. Whereas if I was more kind of studio-based, doing still life and doing kind of fine art type stuff, then I'd probably bias my choice towards a three-way head because that would give me more control over each axis of the composition.
Yeah, I think that's a fair comment. I think I'd agree. I'd go on with the ball head style. I think there's just one thing maybe that we ought to say here, and that is if you are buying a tripod, don't be too much of a cheapskate, actually, because the cheaper tripods that are out there really aren't good enough. If you're out in any kind of little bit of wind, or you're wanting to get yourself into a difficult, tricky position for a macro shot, or even for a, you know, for a landscape shot, whatever, then, you know, they may not have that flexibility. Plus that thing I talked about earlier, that kind of the creep, you know, once you've got it locked up, you know, and then it starts to move slightly, you know, the more money you pay, and tripods and tripod heads are quite expensive, unfortunately, but the more money you pay, the better they become at all those things. And so, you know, a 25 quid tripod's 25 quid for a reason.
Yes, and you'll find often with a 25 quid tripod, you're going to strip it because it'll have plastic threads and you'll be buying another one within 3 months. Whereas if you buy a pro tripod, I mean, the question does refer to a pro tripod, and that means you're going to buy something that's made of either aluminium or carbon. That'll be the sticks, the legs.
Carbon, unless you're a weightlifter, I would suggest is the way to go.
Yeah, if you can afford it. But I mean, aluminium tripods, there's nothing wrong with weight in a tripod. It just depends how much you're prepared to carry. And I use a Neotech a lot of the time, which is no longer available, but that's a Manfrotto tripod, and it is quite a weight to lug around and shoulder, but it covers me for everything, and I've just got used to carrying the weight of it, so now I can depend on it to give me a really solid platform for shooting. If you get something that's too light and too flimsy, it's going to have whip, it'll rotate you, and it won't do its job properly. So tripods are about inconvenience, they're about weight. Get used to those things rather than trying to compromise on the way it's made.
And maybe one last little tip with this that isn't something that's that obvious when you're thinking about buying a tripod. I know we're talking about tripod heads initially, but the thing that you want to bear in mind is the weight thing is an issue if you want to take things abroad. So, I mean, I put my tripod into whole luggage wrapped up in, you know, in clothing and in bubble wrap and all the rest of it. But more than weight, it's actually the length of those legs when closed become yes. really, really important. So have a look at your suitcase and what you might be putting it in, because I know a lot of photo buzzers like to travel and will need to take tripods with them. If you know, you can get little travel tripods too. I've got a couple of those, and they're really useful for taking when you can't get them into your luggage and take them that way. But there is always still a compromise, because they're much lighter and a lot smaller, and therefore not as flexible when you get to where you're going.
Yeah, I mean, a point with that, with professional tripods, you can normally get them in three sections, or there are often four section variations. Yeah. Four section will pack up shorter, but still give you the same sort of shooting height. If you stand up, you know, I mean, I'm about 5'6".
No, so I think you're pushing it there, John.
I don't need to have a particularly tall tripod. But generally speaking, if your tripod, without the center column extended, if your tripod will get your camera to eye level without you having to bend your back, that's a full height tripod, really. So that's what you want to look for. That's a full size tripod, and try not to worry about weight. Weight is actually a good thing with a tripod. But yeah, heads, I think go for a ball head if you're looking at landscapes and wildlife, whereas if you're looking at doing more meticulous studio type stuff, then a three-way head could be good as well.
Our second question comes from, it's also from Anonymous. Should I use ND neutral density grads or rely on post-processing to balance exposure levels in a shot? Well, that sort of this ties it a bit with what we were talking about earlier in the PhotoBuzz podcast, doesn't it, John? So what's your opinion on this?
I think nowadays it's kind of up to you, which sounds like a bit of a cop-out. But if we look at it technically, when you put a neutral density graduated filter or any piece of glass or optical resin in front of the lens, you are technically degrading the performance of the lens. You're introducing something else into the light path. So if your method of working allows you to avoid doing that, that's going to be a positive in terms of overall quality. So I'd say you don't necessarily need ND grads anymore, because you can do it in RAW. You can add grads in RAW software like Adobe Camera Raw or Lightroom, or you can, you know, just do it in Photoshop and you can darken a portion of the frame without affecting the rest of the frame by using adjustment layers.
Or shoot two images, one for the lighter area and one for the darker area.
Yeah, you could shoot a double exposure if you're on a tripod. You could frame up and shoot one one sort of slightly overexposed and one underexposed, you know, compared to the other, to get two shots, one which is optimized for the dark part, let's call that the foreground, and one optimized for the light part, which is the sky.
Well, not even two. I mean, you know, we were talking about HDR earlier. HDR allow you to do that, and you don't necessarily have to be tripoded up. If you're careful, you can handhold and it'll blend those, merge those images together, as long as you haven't done a ridiculous movement. You can.
And you, the software will very accurately auto-align those frames to make sure you've got no mismatches. So I think, I mean, me personally, I tend not to bother too much with grey grads or ND grads nowadays. You know, I've got a set, but I tend not to bring them out because I will do it in software. I think the main reason is speed. I can shoot quicker by just shooting without using a neutral density graduated filter. And there's the faff of positioning it, getting the join in the right place. Do I go for a hard edge or a soft edge? I can make all those decisions later when I'm looking at the screen, you know, when I'm processing the picture. And I can fine-tune it. You know, there are times where you want not two stops of graduation in the darkest part. You want 1.5 or you want 2.5. And I can actually fine-tune that in software to get it exactly as I want it. So I think they're probably something you no longer need in your kit bag, provided you're prepared to do that little bit of extra work in post-processing.
Yeah, they're absolutely not essential anymore, unlike maybe a polarizer, which you can sort of semi-create certain elements of a polarizer in post-processing, but there are certain things that you can't. A straight ND that you might be using to hold back exposure, well, clearly you can't do that after you've taken the shot, so you still need some of those for certain types of work that you do. I think it's interesting. I was an absolute staunch ND grad user. If I was shooting landscapes, you know, I almost certainly have one of those on. These days, less and less, I have to be honest. I think that's just the march of time and the improvement in processing software that's allowed us to pull out the information that's there. Occasionally, I'll still use it. I might want to go old school sometimes, so I've still got... I think I've basically got one now, one that I carry around with me, which is a 0.6, so that's a two stop.
Yeah.
As opposed to the sort of the one stop or the three stop, I just perhaps put that on sometimes and think, well, you know, I'm in no rush here. It'd be nice. It's a nice thing to try and get it, as perfect as possible in camera. So I'll do that. So should you use an ND grad or rely on post processing? You can do either. That's the bottom line here, isn't it? Do either, depending on your personal preferences.
Yeah, I'd agree. Sometimes it does feel good to do something in camera, to get everything right and you line up and you use, you know, optical accessories, light filters, to get the shot you want. And there can be a nice sense of satisfaction from having nailed it right in camera. But it's, I'd say nowadays it's not necessary to do that if you don't want to. So it's just a question of approach. But either approach is absolutely fine. I always go for the cheaper one, you know, and not buying ND grads is more cost effective than buying them.
Spoken like a true cheapskate, which I know you are, John, so that's good.
I'd like to wind up now with a little idea that perhaps you can try next time you're out with your camera. We need a name for it, though, so it's about kind of motivation. Let's call it Photovator. What do you think of that?
Well, I think you've just made... I genuinely think you've just made that up. Photovator. It sounds like you'll be going to be digging up your garden or something.
It's a sort of a compound noun of photography and motivation. So, but yeah. So it's about being motivated to do something. Photovator.
Okay, it's so stupid that I'm going to go with this because it sort of fits in with the PhotoBuzz vibe, I think. So, so this is... Photovator.
We need a jingle for it.
Let's do it.
So, Andrew, have you got a good tip, something that PhotoBuzzers can try, an approach they can take to change their photography or improve their photography? What have you got for us?
Okay, well, I think one really good way to explore composition when you're out with your camera is rather than taking every single lens that you've got, if you've got half a dozen lenses, like most of the guys on PhotoBuzz I know have got a whole bag full of many, many lenses. Rather than take them all, just go out with one lens, and see how you get on with that. you're going to have to use your feet more. You're going to have to walk around. You're going to have to think a lot about what how that one lens works. So if it's a wide angle, you've got to think a lot about foregrounds and you know, and how that kind of the width, if you like, is going to affect your composition. Whereas if you're just going to go out with a medium telephoto, like a 70 to 200, something like that, you've got to think about how that flattening of compression and how you know, and the angles that you're going to take to get something that's interesting. So what is a one lens challenge? The one lens challenge of the what was it again? We're calling this
Photovator.
Thank you. What do you think? Do you reckon that'll work?
I think it's a great idea, and I think if you can, I mean, you mentioned using like a 70 to 200 or a zoom lens. I think if you've got a prime lens, just take that. Or if you're taking a zoom lens, if you don't have primes, then make sure your zoom stays fixed at one particular focal length. So you don't just have one lens, you have one focal length. So you will see the world solely at 28mm or 70mm or 100mm or whatever it is you choose to take with you.
So that should... No, okay, I like that. So rather than one lens challenge, it's actually one focal length challenge.
Yes, if it's a prime, the two will go together. But if it's got a
lot of people
zoom,
don't have primes, is what I'm thinking here. We tend to go on the the zoom lenses these days. So okay, so if you're taking out, I don't know, say 16 to 35mm, then pick 16 or 35. So pick either end of your zoom range, I guess, is what we're saying here.
Don't move the zoom ring. Just stick with one particular focal length and see what you can come up with that. Because it automatically changes your way of seeing the world. It makes you less lazy about composition. You know, one of the great things about zoom lenses is they're very economical. You can stand in one place and go from 70 to 200 with a flick of the wrist. You know, and that's great. That's efficient, but it doesn't necessarily get you in the right places, because when you move, change the sort of subject to camera distance, you're changing perspective and the way things fall together and all sorts. I like that idea.
I tell you what, I know we said we'd only do one idea, but if any of you guys want to take this stage further, here's a little idea, and that is to buddy up with another photo buzzer and both go out to the same location. One use one focal length, so one of you goes with the widest focal length you've got in your collection, and the other one goes with the longest focal length they've got in their collection, and you walk around the same place, location, area, whatever, and you then at the end of the day, when you're done, you're processing and work some bits out, compare notes and see how the other focal length has completely changed the way they've actually photographed that particular place.
That is a fantastic idea. Yeah, and do share your results with the rest of the community as well. Upload your shots and tell us how you got on, because it really is a great way of kind of refocusing your photography and it forces you into doing something you wouldn't normally do, and that's always a good thing. Something good always comes out of that.
Well, that concludes the very first Photo Buzz podcast, and I've really enjoyed it. I know John has too, because he's smiling at me. If you can leave us some comments at the bottom of the page, we'd really like that. Comment on the main topic of the conversation, which was manipulation. Tell us your views on that. And of course, if you want a question answered, and you don't have to be anonymous, but you can be, then you know where we are. So just get in touch with an email and we'll try and cover that next time we are talking to you. So from me, it's goodbye.
And from me, it's goodbye as well. See you next time.